Hello and welcome to Rich Pickings, Fidelity's monthly asset allocation podcast. I'm Richard Edgar, Editor-in-Chief, and with me are some of the multi-asset team. We've got a change to our usual lineup, in fact. Anna Stubnitska will be away for a few months, so taking her place is Charlotte Harrington, markets analyst and...
a keen horsewoman who owns an ex-racehorse called Upstart.
Who, I understand, assaulted you recently.
You may have accidentally kneed me in the face. I hope it was an accident.
I hope so too. Bill McQuaker, portfolio manager and...
recent convert to acupuncture. It's done wonders for my jaw and, more importantly, it's improved my golf.
Which is an improvement on the thigh bones connected to the knee bone or something.
I guess so.
We'll leave that to further discussion. As always, James Bakeman is here, Chief Investment Officer of the Multi-Asset Team and...
someone who's recently, after a 20-year hiatus, gone back to eating fish.
I have to ask why.
I had a string of fishbone-related incidents. And there's a limit to how many times you can be hospitalised with the same thing at the same hospital before you go off the fish entirely as a concept.
Okay, the Queen Mother hospital, somewhere maybe. Okay, well, let's get to the business then. And James, we have to start with the asset allocation. Overall, there was no change. So just remind us where we are, please.
Absolutely. So we remain very cautiously and somewhat uncomfortably overweight equities. So we do like equities. We know we're late cycle, but we still think they're the best place to have your money, and we're underweight fixed income. Within that, we are overweight Europe and underweight US.
Okay, fine. We'll come to those in just a moment. I mean, it does seem like the tide is turning, that funny period when the sea goes calm, but you know that things are about to change. Is that
it's a great metaphor. The challenge is the calm before the storm in markets could be a week or it could be a year. And if you look at a line of a chart of equity markets, you know what? They're just riding up very comfortably. All is good. You look at it and think this is a great time to be invested. And then you start looking at the data. You start looking at the fact that earnings are stretched. You say, well, actually, things shouldn't be this good. And I think the challenge for us is reconciling a market that is basically reacting as if everything in the world is wonderful with a reality that is most definitely not wonderful. But markets can stay like that for a long time. And actually, the greater peril in that context and that situation is not following the trend and not staying with equities.
Okay. And are you holding, not buying equities? Would that be fair?
We're definitely not buying equities. We are holding our positions. We're holding our nerve. We're definitely not increasing our nerve.
Interesting. Okay. And then the country allocations. There was a lot of discussion around Japan. Why?
I mean, Japan is the kind of perennial difficult asset allocation call, partly, as I think Charlotte may want to comment on, the inverse relationship between currency and market, but also because it is a market split between exporters and domestics, and you have to take a call on exporters versus domestics to really make money in Japan, as well as taking a view on the overall picture. So we spent most of our meeting discussing Japan and came to the conclusion we're going to do nothing. But at the same time, I think that was a very fruitful discussion in that there are very strong arguments in both directions.
So the currency is the key point, I suppose, here.
So in the AEG framework, we include the currency, and by and large, currency strength will offset any improvement in the local market and vice versa. So that correlation has tended to be quite tight. The bull case that was laid out for Japan is around a kind of a more manufacturing upswing and increased capex, which we're seeing in various data points, including in the US now. But as I say, that does tend to be offset by the currency, and what you'd really want to see to make that call is a much more or a much stronger domestic improvement within Japan, which is not totally coming through yet.
I think the reason that we had this long discussion and then decided to do nothing is because, to pick up on Charlotte's interest, we felt that the horse has bolted in Japan. If you look back over the previous two or three months, the Japanese equity market had already performed extremely well.
Yeah.
And whilst there were some quite good reasons tabled as to why that had happened, the issue was it had already happened. Japan is historically a market that's, I sometimes refer to it as the home of Mo. It's where momentum does extremely well, and we've unfortunately already seen a period of strong momentum, so we're going to have to wait until another time to get a better chance to buy Japan, I think.
To just overlay with that what we were saying before about the kind of increasing cautiousness around global equity markets, Japan tends to be quite high beta and does quite well when equities are going up, and equities haven't just gone up this year, they've actually gone up incredibly smoothly. Volatility's been very low. It's been a fantastic journey for an investor, and actually any disruption to that could actually hurt Japan quite quite markedly, I think.
And in fact, at a global level, you're a bit more cautious about equities even than James. You'd rather be neutral on equities.
My sense is that, you know, we've been positive as a group all year. I've already mentioned this very low vol picture and an improving growth backdrop. But I do think as we head towards the end of this year and into the beginning of next, there's increasing sign that you're seeing the central banks start to become a little bit less accommodative than they have been this year. Actually, the BOJ very recently had a speech where they indicated that this is certainly their direction of travel. There wasn't very much clarity around timing on that. And so for me, that just is not a bad reason at this stage to take a pause and reflect on really or look forward as to what could be the next calls for the leg higher.
And what about the Fidelity leading indicator? Because that was something where it's been, I think, quite interesting in recent months as we've seen this turning a corner and beginning to look more positive. But where do you think it's going?
Well, so the leading indicator that we look at also feeds into the model. And the way that we look at that is through various different transformations. Actually, if you looked at the model reading from that, it's pretty neutral based on the changes we're looking at. But I think it's fair to say that this year, not only have we had quite a strong upswing at the beginning of the year, it's been very stable at quite high levels. And I think that certainly seems to be continuing to play out as we head towards the end of this year.
And when we look at the leading indicator, I think the challenge is, yes, it's swung up and we didn't actually expect it to in the last few months, but it has. And in a way, that's a really good sign. I think the problem is we can see parallels if we look overlay with 2006, 2007, exactly the same pattern of an unexpected upswing, and we know what happened in 2008. So I think there's that slight echo of the past in our mind. This could actually be good news. It could also be, you know, a real sign that the storm is coming.
And Bill, as a portfolio manager, how much weight do you put on something like the leading indicator at a time like this, when you've got a feeling that's brewing, and then you've got data like this perhaps pointing in a different way?
Well, I don't think it's so much a feeling. I would emphasise we're looking at a broad range of indicators. The leading indicator tells us something important about the kind of rate of change in the growth of the global economy, whether things are accelerating or decelerating. And that's great, and that picture this year has been very encouraging. But there are other things we need to put alongside that. We need to be alert to the fact that asset markets are very fully priced, and perhaps more important still, if you look at the level of risk appetite amongst investors, you look at the extent to which investors have already positioned for this really quite attractive fundamental position, there's a lot of risk already embedded in portfolios, and therein lies a vulnerability.
Well, I just want to come to James, because we've been working on the outlooks for the coming year, and there is this sense from Dominic Rossi, for example, CIO for equities, that the S&P, for example, hasn't got that much further to go. Do you agree?
Well, I think there probably is limited upside. I think that's a fair comment. But upside is still upside. And in a world where nothing's desperately attractively valued in any way, why wouldn't you go for something that might have some upside, first of all? Secondly, Dominic thinks in capital return terms. And when we factor in dividend yield, and you can see another couple of percent on top of that, that actually becomes a potentially interesting thing to be invested in. So yes, the index level may be, you know, reaching its peaks, but there's still upside to come.
Yeah, no, I was just going to add to what Bill said around the risk appetite and the growth backdrop, which is that at this stage it seems to be quite well priced. What maybe is less well priced by markets generally is actually inflation developments as we go forward. And you might expect that inflation would pick up given what has been a very strong year in terms of growth, but also given what's happened in the oil market.
Labour markets,
the potential for wages to rise, and just simple headline inflation, the base effect there is going to see those numbers rise, with the exception of the UK.
It is an interesting point, that, actually, because it's something that has cropped up in the outlooks. Everybody talks about inflation being a potential surprise next year. And yet, just before this recording, we've had the minutes from the Fed, where they seem pretty relaxed about it, quite dovish, actually.
They were referring to a period before the latest core CPI print, which we had, which was a little bit better. But I think it's fair to say that the Fed are scratching their heads as to why inflation has been surprising on the downside, certainly in the first part of this year. They have tended to put this down to sort of transitory effects, but you know, there is a question mark in their mind at the moment, you know, December still looks very live, and obviously things, a lot can change between now and next year. But really, they're trying to get to a neutral rate, which is a rate at which they think they're not boosting growth, but they're not detracting from growth, and everything's on an even keel.
Yeah, I'm surprised that the Fed is sounding dovish again. If you look at the last 3 months of inflation data, it says that inflation is right back at the kind of levels that are close to or at the Fed's target, certainly in terms of CPI, perhaps not PCE, their so-called preferred measure. And looking to next year, I think there are quite a few reasons to believe that the pressure on inflation is going to be to the upside. Things that Charlotte talked about already, energy, wages, a very low unemployment rate. There's not a lot of spare capacity in the US economy. And my suspicion is that in the first half of next year, the market is going to have to reconsider some of these very dovish views on the outlook for inflation and the outlook for global monetary policy.
Okay, so a changing context, we think, at the beginning of next year. How do you position then, Bill, if we think that things, you know, that the tide, we're in that sort of weird intertide period, we don't know which way it is right now. How do you start positioning for that so that you don't miss the end of the bull market, which is something, James, you've talked about many times in this podcast, but you're also not going to be squashed rushing for the exits if things were to turn?
I think there's a couple of things that work in my portfolios. One is a position in the S&P 500 that I think of as something of an each way bet. The S&P is quite a special index. In fact, I sometimes refer to it as the most beautiful of indices, and that's because it's remarkably diversified and. At the moment, there's two characteristics that it offers that I like. The first is 20-25% of the S&P is invested in so-called FANGs, these high-growth super companies that have really changed the world over the last few years, the likes of Facebook and Apple and Google and so on. And if James is right, if there is going to be a final significant move up in equity markets, I would be very, very surprised if those companies don't participate. Perhaps indeed lead it. So I get some exposure to that upside possibility. Indeed, because momentum matters in markets, and there's a decent chance that in the first half of next year, momentum is a driving force, because the world doesn't change, as I've just suggested it might, and people have got to do something with their money. However, there's also a decent chance that some of these concerns that we've been alluding to this morning come to bear. And if that happens, if there is going to be a setback for markets, then the fact that the S&P is a low beta market that typically outperforms most, or perhaps even all, other equity markets when things take a setback, I quite like building that.
That sounds beautiful to you, then.
That is a thing of beauty. So that's one way of moulding the portfolio to accommodate different circumstances.
And also this idea that American money is what has pumped markets, some markets around the world, higher. And if things did start to turn, that money would be repatriated and it's got to go somewhere. Does that have an impact?
I think that has more of an impact on the dollar than it does on the S&P 500. Yeah, if we go risk off and you see some repatriation of US capital back to the US, I don't think the first place that money will go is the stock market.
So
it's more
like
it go to bonds or cash, as you say. It will come out of other currencies into US dollars, and that can be significant.
So summary then is no change in the asset allocation, but you're beginning to feel a little bit less comfortable as we go on, beginning to feel the heat. How do you play things from here then, James?
I think it's very carefully watching what's going on. You're waiting with the thing you know you're going to miss, which is the peak of the bull market. No one times it right. We're not going to time it right. But you can get as close as you can. And I think that means watching data, watching geopolitics, taking, you know, advantage of buying opportunities if they come. If we see a small sell-off but we think the trend's up, you know, pushing back in, but at the same time being very ready to move risk off as and when it feels
right. Does your focus narrow then onto much more individual opportunities?
Well, I think, you know, the broad position has to be, remain risk on. You know, we're going to come to hot cake, hot potato, and you're kind of stealing my thunder here, Richard. But
no, you just stolen mine.
Oh, sorry. But I think, you know, actually, one of the ways you play this is to take risk just through alpha or through uncorrelated betas, so alternatives. And actually, I think, you know, one of the things we're increasingly doing is saying we can't own cash because cash is underperforming inflation, and therefore, why not be in long short equities or other alternatives that deliver an upside irrespective of market conditions? So maybe that's where your marginal capital goes at the moment.
And another strategy is to look for parts of the asset market mix that have somehow or another missed out in the big trends. And two things are interesting at the moment, in my opinion. The first is energy, where energy in the first half of this year in particular dramatically underperformed its fundamentals. The oil price didn't go up when, in our judgment, it probably should have done. And energy equities performed even worse. So in the summer months, we added to both those assets, and so far that's proven to be quite an astute call for there's been something of a catch up since the middle of the year. Another asset that is attractive at the moment in a similar way is Spain. The situation in Catalonia has caused Spanish equities to underperform broad Europe quite significantly. We think that the situation will be resolved, and as the situation normalises, I think there's every reason to think that Spanish equities catch up with the rest of Europe.
Okay, well, we have reached the end, and I think you have beaten me to the hot cakes, your hot cakes recommendation of something which is selling very well, you like to buy it. What then is your hot potato? What would you drop?
James? The hot potato is cash. It absolutely is cash. I do not understand why an active investor would want a meaningful allocation to an asset that is underperforming inflation, because you're just losing purchasing power constantly whilst owning it.
Okay, Charlotte? Your hotcakes.
I'm going to say commodity-linked currencies, so Norwegian krona or Canadian dollar, which have lagged the move up in the oil price.
And your hot potato?
I'm going to say Italy, because Italy has outperformed all countries, I think, in Europe this year, and we are heading into an election, and there are still some structural difficulties in that market.
A lot of uncertainty, as always. Bill, your hotcake.
Hotcake is the euro. I think the European economy is doing quite nicely, and I think next year European monetary policy might have to shift a bit quicker than the market's thinking, and that'll be good for the euro.
Hot potato?
Emerging markets. I look back over the last couple of years, they've had a phenomenal run, and if the environment is going to be a bit more risk neutral, I think one of the places that capital will come out is emerging markets.
Interesting. Okay, well, thank you very much indeed. We're out of time. I hope that's given you an insight into the thinking behind this month's asset allocation. If you'd like more detail, it's published in full on our website, and if you'd like to discuss anything we've covered, just ask your Fidelity contact. Thanks very much indeed to my guests, Charlotte, Bill and James, and thanks to you for listening. We'll be back in a month for our last podcast of the year. But for now, goodbye.
This podcast is for investment professionals only and should not be relied on by private investors. This podcast is provided for information purposes only and is intended only for the person or entity to which it is sent. It must not be reproduced or circulated to any other party without prior permission of Fidelity. The value of investments can go down as well as up, so you may get back less than you invest. For other important legal notices, please see our website or the Fidelity SoundCloud or iTunes apps.